Welcome to this podcast titled Communication is Key, where we are drawing on the content from the print edition of the June 2024 Clinical Communique. I'm Associate Professor Nicola Cunningham, the Editor-in-Chief of this series. This podcast explores the core theme of communication in healthcare. The two feature cases demonstrate the ways in which poor or missed communication between treating teams and their patients, family members, and other clinicians can impact significantly on patient safety. The episode concludes with two expert commentaries. The first, by Dr. Mary Dahm, an expert on communication in healthcare, who shares her insights on the critical importance of communication at all points of the patient's hospital journey. And the second expert commentary is by Mr. Peter McDermott from the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare, who highlights concepts and practices surrounding open disclosure. Let's now listen to Ashley Redmond narrate the editorial.
Contents. Editorial. Case 1. Closing the loop. Case 2. A critical procedure. Expert commentary. At the core. Communication as a key to patient safety. Expert commentary. The Australian Open Disclosure Framework. Past, present, and future. Editorial. Associate Professor Nicola Cunningham. Welcome to episode 16 of the Clinical Communique, based on the June 2024 edition of the Clinical Communique. In this episode, we feature two surgical cases that each portray several clinical themes, but at the heart of both is the theme of communication. In their ensuing inquests, the coroners explored how the treating teams communicated with the patient and their family members, where conversations around consent, post-operative complications, and open disclosure were lacking, and how those treating teams communicated with their own colleagues, where missed opportunities in communication hindered timely diagnoses. The issue of communication as a key component of patient safety in healthcare has been explored in previous episodes of the Communiques. In our January 2020 edition of the Future Leaders Communique, guest editor Dr. Erin Malin presents a case involving delayed post-operative complications following spinal cord decompression surgery and highlights the pitfalls of gaps in communication. Professor John Botha reflects in his expert commentary on the importance of interdisciplinary communication in complex cases. Our October 2021 edition of the Future Leaders Communique by guest editor Emily Lin explores communication in the health professional-patient relationship. This edition is featured in episode 7 of our Future Leaders Communique podcast series. Professor Michelle Leach and Professor Justin Oakley discuss ethical concerns regarding communication, consent, and accountability, and the lifelong need to continue developing communication skills. That edition and its accompanying podcast closes with a list of insights provided by the patient's family to the coroner on how the care of their loved one could have been improved. It is a powerful reminder of what patients need and deserve from their treating teams: to be listened to, understood, and involved in the decision-making. To feel that their clinicians are being open and honest with them and respectful of their needs. These are all vital components of communication in medicine. They are the skills that we need to develop and prioritize in every interaction we undertake as clinicians. As the coroner noted in one of the cases, communication with families during treatment and after death, if that be the outcome, must be a part of the culture of the workplace. Equally important as improving communication with patients and families is addressing how colleagues communicate with each other. Empowering team members to speak up and share concerns or uncertainty about a patient's diagnosis or treatment is a fundamental enabler of team performance. This was reflected in the other case by the coroner's comment that what might be considered slightly outdated politeness within medical hierarchy should be set aside in favour of the life of the patient. The cases in this episode are supported by two excellent expert commentaries. Dr. Mary Dahm, who is an Australian Research Council DECRA Fellow and Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for Communication in Healthcare at the Australian National University, shares her insights on the critical importance of communication at all points of the patient's hospital journey and describes its impact on how we diagnose accurately, achieve informed consent, and recognise complications in a timely manner. Mr. Peter McDermott from the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare highlights concepts and practices surrounding open disclosure, a process that all clinicians must understand and do well. How do you keep two people connected with a shared understanding of important critical information? Whatever combination of doctors, nurses, patients, or their loved ones, effective communication is the glue that maintains that connection. This bond can be weakened by perceived hierarchical barriers, avoidance of difficult conversations, or lack of a common language. It is a bond that needs repeated attention to ensure it stays intact. Nobody complains about too much information sharing when adverse events occur. So, to ensure effective communication and an inclusive, patient-centered approach to healthcare, maybe we should all shift towards erring on the side of too much rather than too little.
Let's now listen to the case summary from New South Wales.
Case 1. Closing the Loop. Case Precy author, Dr. Rachel Ma, forensic physician. Clinical summary. Mr. W.E. was a 79-year-old widower who lived independently and had two adult sons and a daughter. His past medical history included hypertension, high cholesterol, atrial fibrillation, heart failure, ischemic heart disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mr. W.E. had been discharged from hospital following an admission for a chest infection. The following day, he presented to his local rural health service after he collapsed while in the bathroom at his home. He was assessed in the emergency department of the rural health service, where he reported some abdominal pain and having felt faint after voiding in the toilet. He was tender over his left abdominal area and his vital signs were within the normal range. He was admitted to the health service to await blood tests and abdominal imaging the following morning, but he deteriorated overnight and was urgently transferred to the nearest regional hospital for further review and management. When Mr. W.E. arrived at the regional hospital, he was hypotensive and had severe abdominal pain. He was triaged as a Category 1 patient and moved into the resuscitation bay. He underwent a CT scan of his abdomen and was then assessed by the surgical registrar, Dr. D. The CT scan demonstrated that Mr. W.E. had a perforated bowel with evidence of extensive fecal material having leaked into the abdominal cavity. Mr. W.E. was informed of his condition and consented to being intubated. Dr. D. called the on-call general surgeon, Dr. S., and discussed Mr. W.E.'s presentation and the need for emergency surgery. Dr. D. then spoke with one of Mr. W.E.'s sons to obtain consent for an exploratory laparotomy, with repair of the bowel perforation and the possible need for a bowel resection. Dr. S. performed the surgery, with Dr. D. assisting for part of the surgery. Dr. S.'s handwritten operation report indicated that a Hartmann's procedure, where part of the large bowel is removed and the proximal end forms a stoma on the abdominal wall, was performed after the fecal contamination was washed out of the abdominal cavity. Following the surgery, Mr. W.E. was admitted to the intensive care unit. Over the next 2 days, Mr. W.E.'s stoma was noted to be pink and dusky and draining dark material or blood. No stool was passing from the stoma and there was an absence of bowel sounds. At the surgical ward rounds led by the surgical registrar and at the intensive care unit team reviews, it was thought that Mr. W.E. was experiencing an ileus, a common post-operative complication following major abdominal surgery whereby the bowel exhibits low or no motility. Issues with ongoing confusion, abdominal pain, requiring increasing amounts of analgesia, and an absence of output from the stoma continued for several days. Nursing entries noted nil fecal output and inactive stoma. The nasogastric tube was on free drainage with fecal fluid draining. On the fifth post-operative day, the ICU team noted 840 mL of fecal fluid had drained from the nasogastric tube over the previous 24 hours. Mr. W.E. had a soft abdomen with no bowel sounds at the time. The ICU consultant raised his concerns about a possible post-operative complication with the surgical registrar, who stated he would communicate those concerns to Dr. S. Dr. S. reviewed Mr. W.E. with her surgical team on day 6 and noted similar findings to the ICU team. The stoma was swollen and the possibility of a bowel obstruction was documented. The surgical team's management plan did not include imaging, but rather for Mr. W.E. to drink clear fluids and mobilise with the aid of physiotherapy. The pain team reviewed Mr. W.E. on days 6 and 7 and noted that his abdominal pain was such that he had increasing requirements for fentanyl. A surgical ward round on day 7, led by another registrar, Dr. R, made no changes to their management plan. Dr. S did not attend Mr. W.E. in person that day, though it was documented that she was updated with regards to Mr. W.E.'s progress. On day 8, the ICU consultant requested that another surgeon, Dr. J, provide a second opinion with regards to the management of Mr. W.E. Dr. J reviewed Mr. W.E. that morning and then spoke to Dr. S and organised a CT scan of the abdomen. Dr. J reviewed the CT images with the radiologist and the ICU consultant. They identified that the proximal end of the bowel was located in the pelvis and was stapled. Dr. J returned to Mr. W.E. and formed the view that the wrong end of the bowel, the rectal pouch, had been used to form the stoma and that the large bowel had been incorrectly sealed, causing a mechanical bowel obstruction. By this time, Mr. W.E. was experiencing severe pain and had a distended, tight and tender abdomen despite potent analgesia. He had also just learned about the sudden and unexpected death of one of his adult sons. He became tachycardic, hypertensive, and his oxygen saturations dropped to 85% on room air. Dr. J informed Dr. S of the surgical error and proposed that a transverse loop colostomy be performed as a rescue procedure. Dr. J was not present when Dr. S spoke to Mr. W.E. to explain what had happened during the first operation and obtain consent for the transverse loop colostomy to remedy the error. Dr. J and Dr. S performed the surgery that day, day 8 after the first surgery. Between days 9 to 12, the stoma started to function, but Mr. W.E. did not appear to improve. A further CT scan showed a small bowel obstruction, proximal to the stoma. Dr. J returned Mr. W.E. to theatre for a re-look laparotomy and subtotal colectomy, but Mr. W.E. deteriorated intraoperatively. The bowel was stapled off and a temporary dressing was put in place to allow Mr. W.E. to return to the ICU for management of his deterioration. He was not well enough to return to theatre until 2 days later, where the entire large bowel and some of the small bowel was removed and an end ileostomy was created. Mr. W.E. returned to the ICU after his third operation, and after an initial period of improvement, he deteriorated again. A family meeting with his two surviving children was held and a decision was made to focus on palliative care and end-of-life comfort. Mr. W.E. passed away 25 days after his first surgery. Pathology. An autopsy was conducted. the findings of which included multiple collections of pus in the abdomen, including over the surface of the liver, spleen, and peritoneum, necrosis of the peritoneum, and distended necrotic bowel. Swabs were positive for Enterococcus faecium. Other findings included evidence of a recent myocardial infarction, which was 3 to 5 days old, pleural effusions, and a small incidental right renal cell carcinoma. The cause of death was listed as complications of peritonitis. Contributing factors included the surgical error made by Dr. S, the delay in diagnosing the bowel obstruction caused by medical treatment, and underlying natural causes. Investigation. A coronial inquest was held pursuant to state law as it appeared to the coroner that the manner and cause of Mr. W.E.'s death had not been sufficiently disclosed. The coronial inquest was conducted to explore the nature of the surgical error, including whether it was avoidable, as well as the appropriateness of the care Mr. W.E. received in the days after the original surgery, and whether the mechanical bowel obstruction should have been identified sooner. Other issues that were explored included the adequacy of Dr. S's open disclosure of the surgical error to Mr. W.E. and his son, whether it was appropriate for Dr. S to continue to provide medical care to Mr. W.E. after the identification of the surgical error, and whether the hospital had adequate tools for monitoring surgical outcomes. Medical records and statements from those involved in Mr. W.E.'s care at the health services he attended in the lead-up to his final illness were perused. Evidence was heard from several experts, including general surgeons, colorectal surgeons, and intensive care physicians. Mr. W.E.'s family also provided statements to the coroner. During the inquest, several matters were addressed in detail. There was no dispute with regard to the finding of the surgical error made by Dr. S in creating a stoma with the rectal pouch instead of the proximal segment of large bowel after the diseased portion of bowel was resected. Matters that were explored included: the expert surgeons gave evidence that they could not understand how the surgical error was made in the first place, even in the setting of distorted anatomy, and that the error was avoidable. It was noted that Dr. S had only performed one other Hartmann's procedure on her own. The evidence suggested that Dr. S did not personally review Mr. W.E. until 6 days after the original surgery. She relied on information relayed to her by her team and could not recall whether she had been aware of factors such as the increased NGT output. The experts considered that given Mr. W.E.'s guarded prognosis, he required daily in-person reviews by his surgeon. The experts agreed that the combination of no stoma output, increasing nasogastric tube output, increasing analgesia requirements, and abdominal distension should have prompted the request for a CT scan by day 6. The ICU consultant gave evidence that he brought up his concerns about Mr. W.E. to Dr. S's registrar on day 6 and was told that the surgical team were not concerned. He also gave evidence that he made a phone call to Dr. S on day 6, which was not answered, and left a message. His concern for Mr. W.E. grew to a point where, on the morning of day 8, he took the unusual step of calling another surgeon, Dr. J, and requesting a second opinion. Once the surgical error was identified, it was Dr. J's evidence that he offered to participate in the open disclosure Dr. S would make to Mr. W.E. to explain what had occurred. Dr. S stated that she did not recall such an offer being made. She had a conversation with Mr. W.E. on the evening of day 8. It was the evidence of two intensive care nurses who overheard most of Dr. S's discussion with Mr. W.E. that she did not adequately explain that Mr. W.E.'s condition and need for further surgery was due to a surgical error on her part. The nurses were also concerned that Mr. W.E. did not understand much of what Dr. S was saying. Further, the documentation in Mr. W.E.'s medical record by Dr. S. did not adequately explain that a surgical error had occurred, causing the mechanical bowel obstruction. Dr. S. stated she rang Mr. W.E.'s son to discuss the error, but he had no recollection of such a phone call, despite Dr. S. having documented its occurrence in the notes. Dr. J., who performed the second surgical procedure, undertook open disclosure with Mr. W.E. and his son and explained to them the nature of the surgical error that had occurred and what was planned to rectify the problem. The coroner heard that the health service did not have formal processes in place to track or monitor surgical complications and relied on voluntary reporting. Coroner's findings. The coroner found that Dr. S's surgical error was unexpected and unexplained in Mr. W.E.'s case. Further, the assumption that Mr. W.E.'s lack of stoma output was due to an ileus and the failure to rule out other important possibilities, including mechanical bowel obstruction, may have been questioned sooner had Dr. S reviewed Mr. W.E. in person. The lack of engagement by Dr. S with Mr. W.E.'s treating ICU consultant also contributed to missed opportunities and the delay in Mr. W.E.'s diagnosis and management. Once the surgical error was identified, the coroner was critical of Dr. S's lack of robust open disclosure with Mr. W.E. and his family. The coroner recommended that details of the coronial investigation be forwarded to the Healthcare Complaints Commissioner to review the care that Dr. S provided to Mr. W.E. The health service considers developing a surgical audit tool to facilitate the capture of surgical outcome data in real time. The health service and the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare consider implementing a policy or promulgating a directive whereby a witness of equal or higher seniority is present for the initial disclosure of a medical complication by the health practitioner who made the error. Such a policy or directive should also outline that, where practicable, the patient is informed they can request that the doctor who made the error is no longer involved in their care. Author's comments. Errors do occur in the course of providing medical care. When they occur, they are distressing for the patient and their family, as well as for the healthcare providers responsible. The process of open disclosure, of providing patients and their families with a detailed account of the error and its effects, is an important process which allows patients and families to understand what has occurred and make informed decisions about their subsequent management. Listening has arguably even greater importance than speaking when it comes to communication in a healthcare setting. There were several lost opportunities for communication between the surgeon and other clinicians after the surgical error occurred that may have resulted in earlier diagnoses and a better prognosis for the patient.
Let's now listen to the case summary from the Northern Territory.
Case 2. A critical procedure. Case Precy author, Dr. Christian Boyle, emergency physician. Clinical summary. In March 2017, the Northern Territory Coroner's Court received a handwritten letter. It said, "I would be very grateful if you could read my husband's records. His name is D.F., and he passed away 19th of October 2010. Mr. D.F. was a 67-year-old married man who worked as an engineering sales representative. His past medical history included bowel perforation and hemicolectomy, which is removal of part of the large bowel, adhesion-related small bowel obstructions, a hiatus hernia, where the stomach protrudes through the diaphragm, a heart attack, and gastroesophageal reflux disease that caused recurrent chest infections and pain." Mrs. DF's letter went on to say, "He had a large hiatus hernia, and although he was always in pain, an operation was never mentioned until the doctor had no option but to operate. On the 21st of September, he was admitted to a major referral hospital for an elective laparoscopic keyhole, hiatus hernia repair. The surgery was uncomplicated and he was discharged home on day 3. The letter described, DF was allowed home that day, even though he was still in pain. But after 2 weeks and 2 days, he was in so much pain, I took him back. Mr. DF had ongoing abdominal pain following his repair that culminated in an overnight emergency department presentation on the 8th of October. He was assessed by an emergency doctor who ordered an X-ray and CT of the abdomen, followed by a surgical review. The imaging showed no signs of bowel obstruction, but the stomach had twisted and moved upwards with potential compromise to its blood supply, so he was referred back to Dr. T, the surgeon who had performed the original hernia repair. Mr. DF's pain remained challenging to control despite regular opioid analgesia. Many diagnoses were in consideration at various stages, including diverticulitis, bowel obstruction, heart attack, post-operative pain with scar tissue narrowing, and lack of blood supply to the bowel, which was noted as unlikely. Mid-afternoon, on the day of presentation, Dr. T took Mr. DF for exploratory laparoscopy with a small possibility of need for a laparotomy, open abdominal surgery, noted. The laparoscopic procedure revealed some swelling to the tissues of the stomach, but no findings that would explain the degree of pain he had been experiencing. And after a period in recovery, he was transferred to the ward. Mrs. DF wrote, later the next day, he was taken for a CT scan. Doctor wouldn't let me go with him, and I was told he would either go to surgery or ICU. I was just left not knowing. When I did see DF again, he was in ICU, hooked up to so many machines. The pattern of unrelenting pain continued the following day, requiring escalating doses of morphine. By early afternoon, Mr. DF had deteriorated, with an increasing heart rate and low blood pressure. He had a tender and guarded abdomen, and his C-reactive protein was 320, where levels greater than 10 milligrams per litre are indicative of an acute inflammation or infection. At 4:40 p.m., when a repeat abdominal CT scan was again non-diagnostic, it was documented that he was not for operative management at this stage. At 5:45 p.m., his vital signs were critically unstable, and he was admitted to ICU with a diagnosis of intra-abdominal sepsis, infection of the abdominal cavity. By midnight, he was intubated and on a ventilator. At 10 a.m. the following morning, 58 hours after he first presented to the ED, he was taken to theatre for a laparotomy. There, he was found to have multiple areas of ischemic necrosis, dead or dying tissue due to lack of blood supply, of the small bowel. This had led to bowel perforation and fecal peritonitis. The letter's description finished with, "We never spoke to each other again. On the 11th day, he passed away at 11 p.m. at night." Mr. DF remained in ICU on multi-organ support for the following 9 days, with 5 return trips to the operating theatre. At the final surgery, the degree of bowel ischemia was found to be incompatible with survival, and he passed away later that evening. Pathology. Mr. DF's cause of death was found to be perforated ischemic bowel leading to fecal peritonitis, septic shock, and multi-organ failure. The case was not reported to the coroner. The rationale, later given for this by the ICU team, was that at the time of his admission to ICU, Mr. DF was not expected to survive. Thus, the death was not unexpected. In 2017, Mr. DF's wife sent her letter to the coroner requesting a review of his case after seeing a similar case covered in the media. Mrs. DF explained, "I feel I need to do this for DF. After 6.5 years, this is still upsetting me." Investigation. The inquest into Mr. DF's death was held as a discretionary inquest together with that of another case from the same hospital. Despite the cases occurring 6 years apart, there were a number of shared features between the two. The focus of the combined inquests included delayed diagnosis, poor communication with families, failure to report deaths meeting criteria to the coroner. There were numerous statements presented as evidence. The health service submitted a formal institutional response and was represented at the inquest. Their director of surgical services also gave evidence, as did Dr. T. An expert opinion was requested from an interstate surgeon who opined that while the exploratory laparoscopy on 8th of October was not an unreasonable starting point, the lack of findings was misinterpreted as a lack of pathology. This led to a 48-hour delay before further surgical intervention, where adhesive obstruction and feculent peritonitis was diagnosed. Dr. T accepted this feedback and acknowledged he should have reported the case to the coroner, offering an apology to Mr. DF's wife. The director of surgical services also agreed that the degree of suspicion for ischemic bowel had been inadequate. Along with medical evidence, a statement was taken from Mr. DF's wife. In addition to the details in her letter, she gave evidence of minimal contact with doctors during the 9-day ICU stay, as well as never receiving a proper explanation as to her husband's cause of death. The only information she had received was from the death certificate. The health service acknowledged the breakdown in communication, agreeing these occurred too frequently. Coroner's findings. While the formal findings were limited to the particulars of death, the comments were frank and uncompromising. The coroner found communication with families was poor, affirming the 8-year delay in a proper explanation to Mr. DF's wife was not right. The legal requirements surrounding reportable deaths were emphasised. The rationale that the death was expected at the time of admission to ICU and therefore not reportable was unequivocally rejected. The challenges of diagnosing bowel ischemia were acknowledged, but it was noted that the referral back to the original treating surgeon had potentially introduced a cognitive bias towards operative complications over a broader diagnostic lens. In response, the surgical services director detailed a number of relevant changes made since the cases in question. These included a multidisciplinary complex case protocol and a pause on the day after a patient death, allowing for a team debrief and review of case details. The death documentation process was also being revised to require justification by the admitting consultant of a decision not to report a death. The coroner made 3 recommendations: that all medical staff have appropriate induction and training regarding communication with families, that the health service ensures that following a death, there is a process of open disclosure, and that reasonable needs of families are met, that the health service ensures all deaths are reported to the coroner in accordance with the law. Author's comments. There are so many steps that can go wrong in a diagnostic journey, and certain ones can be wickedly tricky. Aortic dissection, ovarian torsion, and, indeed, ischemic bowel are frequent presenters in case reviews and coroner's findings. All can present with pain, disproportionate to physical findings, requiring trust in the patient's reported symptoms over seemingly more reliable, objective findings. They also require a high index of diagnostic suspicion. If you don't consider it, you won't diagnose it. Building cognitive forcing strategies and checkpoints into your diagnostic process can buffer against missing these high stakes yet relatively uncommon conditions. Poorly explained, unrelenting pain is a good trigger point to step back and consider, what could I be missing? Perhaps, more importantly, the report validated the experience of Mr. DF's wife, a woman who triggered a coronial inquest with a handwritten letter. Losing a spouse will always be painful, but her long tale of unresolved grief was preventable. It might be easy to judge the lack of communication with her, but it is more helpful to ask why. Why did senior staff members not sit down with her and speak to her about her husband? It could have made all the difference if someone had explained what had happened and told her, gently, but clearly, there is a very good chance that he will die from this. We are so sorry. Then, given her time to ask questions and answered them openly and honestly. If a proper discussion had occurred, those 9 days in ICU might have been very different. As the world folds inward and time becomes liminal, a bedside vigil can become an important part of the death ritual. And when there is no longer a warm hand to hold, memories of the prolonged goodbye are a source of comfort to return to. These conversations can be uncomfortable. Anger and grief can feel like a personal attack, triggering defensiveness or a desire to flee. Showing up with a curious and compassionate mindset, leaning into the discomfort, having the emotional self-regulation to know your own triggers. These are not soft skills. While there is no doubt some people are innately better communicators than others, there is evidence that communication can improve with reflective practice, as well as that it can be taught. For this to occur, though, it needs to be seen as having equal importance to other clinical tasks, not just slotted in, if we have time. When communication fails, great harm can occur. It should be valued, practiced, and taught, just like any other critical procedure.
Let's now listen to the expert commentary by Dr. Mary Dalm.
Expert commentary. At the core, communication as a key to patient safety. Dr. Mary Dalm, Australian Research Council DECRA Fellow and Senior Research Fellow, Institute for Communication in Healthcare, Australian National University. Communication sits at the heart of every clinical interaction. Effective communication builds relationships, enhances trust, increases safe care delivery, drives positive patient outcomes, and reduces complaints or malpractice claims. Yet, paradoxically, communication is the one core skill in healthcare that is often neglected. Most clinicians acknowledge its importance, often in passing, and describe communication skills as a soft skill, positioned at the periphery of the clinician's arsenal of skills, with technical skills and medical knowledge taking the prime positions. Frequently, communication skills are conceptualized as something you either have or you don't. But being a good communicator is not something we are necessarily born with, just like suturing, cannulation, and conducting a complex neurological exam. Effective communication is a skill that can be honed through practice and reflection. In this commentary, I reflect on the critical role of communication throughout the patient journey in the tragic deaths of Mr. W.E. and Mr. D.F. Listening. Always. At the start of his patient story, and even before Mr. D.F. was admitted to hospital, his wife noted how her husband's reports of pain did not trigger adequate responses until surgery was the only option left. In hospital and following laparoscopic surgery, his significant pain was again not given enough attention, contributing to his misdiagnosis and untimely death. When their concerns are dismissed, patients often feel unheard and invalidated in seeking help. They might even delay seeking care in the future, leading to further potential delays in diagnosis and treatment for subsequent health problems. Cognitive bias, including labeling patients and health problems, can further contribute to clinicians not hearing or not adequately attending to patients' symptoms and concerns. Feelings of dismissal and framing valid concerns as irrelevant or downplaying the emotional toll of patients' symptoms is a long-standing communication issue in healthcare. Certain patient groups, such as women, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and members of the LGBTQIA+ community are more vulnerable to being dismissed. Patient-centered communication strategies, such as actively demonstrating empathy by exploring and attending to a patient's emotions and concerns, offering reassurance, and truly taking their perspectives into account, can prevent negative patient experiences. When patients or their carers voice concerns repeatedly and express worry that they are not improving or, in fact, getting worse, clinicians should genuinely explore those concerns so as not to miss the first subtle sign of deterioration. Patient escalation programs such as REACH or Ryan's Rule can also assist patients and carers who feel unheard. But these programs are not yet implemented in all states and territories and do not cover primary and community care. Communication is a team sport. Communication in clinical settings is often synchronous. That is, it occurs in real time through face-to-face conversations or phone calls. However, asynchronous communication between clinicians via clinical progress notes, requests, and investigation reports is also common. Clinicians may not necessarily think of documentation, such as progress notes, as a mode of communication, but rather as merely means for keeping a record. Frequent and effective communication among the clinical team throughout the patient journey is a prerequisite for safe patient care, facilitating collaboration and early identification of potential problems. This includes medical handovers and nursing handovers, but also consultations and check-ins for multidisciplinary teams. Asynchronous communication between multidisciplinary teams is a potential safety risk, as the two patient journeys in this edition demonstrate. Both cases experienced communication breakdowns due to largely asynchronous communication. The limited initial real-time communication between clinicians from different treating teams might have caused the significance of similar observations to be overlooked, resulting in a delay in recognizing patient deterioration. In both cases, clinical suspicions and significant observations were largely recorded in notes, such as the inactive stoma, combined with fecal nasogastric output in Mr. WE's notes, and diagnostic uncertainty, such as bowel ischemia unlikely, in Mr. DF's notes. Real-time multidisciplinary clinical team meetings, or huddles, provide opportunities for clinicians to share their thoughts and observations and to build an organization-wide patient safety culture. In more practical terms, when the same clinical findings and concerns are shared verbally in real time rather than hidden in notes, their combined weight increases and may allow clinicians to identify diagnostic errors or deterioration earlier rather than in hindsight. Frequent communication within and across teams fosters trust and psychological safety, encouraging individuals to voice concerns and contribute their expertise without fear of judgment. Communication builds relationships. Communication between patient and clinicians is, at its core, a relational activity. Such interpersonal conversations are by their very nature collaborative, as people co-construct meanings and relationships within the interaction. Traditionally, patient-clinician interactions have suffered from knowledge and power differentials, with patients deferring to clinicians. However, power relationships have significantly changed with the advent of patient-centered care, informed consent, and open disclosure. Patients and carers should always be equal partners in their clinical interactions, with equal rights to being heard and provided with information. During their hospital stays, both Mr. WE and Mr. DF and their families experienced a lack of communication from either the main treating clinician or clinical teams. The surgical consultant responsible for Mr. WE did not personally visit the patient's ICU bedside for several days past his surgery, and up to that point did not speak to the patient directly, nor to the ICU team looking after him. Such silence naturally precludes the patient and their family from building a relationship or rapport with their consultant. Strong, trusting relationships require regular, mutually beneficial interactions. If patients do not have the chance to frequently communicate with their main treating clinicians, they are at risk of losing their autonomy and opportunities for informed decision-making. Patients may interpret prolonged absences and limited interactions as a lack of respect and lack of interest in their well-being, which impacts on their dignity and can lead to feelings of anxiety and stress. In Mr. W.E.'s case, the limited information Mr. W.E. received about the error and the proposed second procedure further hindered his ability to make a truly informed decision. Informed consent requires patient capacity, voluntariness, specificity in relation to procedures to be undertaken, and adequate information to allow for informed decision-making. Information needs to be sufficiently, openly, and honestly communicated in line with patients' preferences and in a way that patients can understand and appreciate. Otherwise, there is no true consent. The surgeon did not undertake robust open disclosure to Mr. W.E., and thus he was not fully informed about all aspects of his upcoming surgery and the surgeon who would perform it. Communication does not end when the patient dies. In Mr. D.F.'s case, the lack of communication with his wife and family was also striking. Clinicians provided Mr. D.F.'s wife with limited information about his management or updates about his condition, effectively leaving his family in the dark. It is very easy to imagine how scared, anxious, and abandoned his wife felt, given the dearth of information she received before and after her husband's death. Bereavement support is crucial following unexpected deaths, including from sepsis, following diagnostic or surgical errors. Families and caregivers should never be left feeling alone or abandoned. Open, honest, and compassionate communication with families should continue even after a patient's death to provide support during the grieving process. Bereavement support should be offered through the hospital, and if patients do not want hospital-based support, alternatives should be suggested. Effective communication is not a luxury or add-on, but a core component of safe and compassionate healthcare. Focusing on communication honors the trust patients place in clinicians and ensures that every interaction contributes to their autonomy, care, and well-being. Effective communication requires active listening, collaborative communication between patients and the clinical team, and among different clinical teams, transparency throughout the patient journey, and compassion when a patient dies.
Let's now listen to the expert commentary by Mr. Peter McDermott.
The Australian Open Disclosure Framework, Past, Present, and Future. Mr. Peter McDermott, Senior Project Officer, Communicating for Safety, Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. What is open disclosure? Open disclosure describes the way clinicians should communicate with and support patients, their family, and carers who have experienced harm during healthcare. The elements of open disclosure, according to the 2013 Australian Open Disclosure Framework, are an apology or expression of regret, which should include the words, "I am sorry," or "We are sorry." A factual explanation of what happened. An opportunity for the patient, their family, and carers to relate their experience. A discussion of the potential consequences of the adverse event. An explanation of the steps being taken to manage the adverse event and prevent recurrence. Open disclosure encourages clinicians to acknowledge that an adverse event has happened and to apologize or express regret for what has occurred. Open disclosure does not, of itself, create legal liability. Why is open disclosure important? Open disclosure is important because it leads to better outcomes for both patients and clinicians. Done well, open disclosure reduces blame and anger and improves interpersonal relationships by creating an opportunity for all parties to express themselves openly and without judgment. Responding to adverse events with openness and honesty helps to restore and maintain patients' trust in their healthcare providers and, in turn, trust in the wider healthcare system. Open disclosure can also help clinicians who may experience feelings of guilt, shame, loss of confidence, anxiety, fatigue, and burnout following an adverse event. Properly supported, open disclosure can support clinicians through some of these challenges. Open disclosure policy history. While many clinicians have always practiced open disclosure informally because it is just the right thing to do, it has taken over 20 years to become a standardized regular practice in many healthcare organizations, starting with the Australian Open Disclosure Standard in 2003 and developing into the Australian Open Disclosure Framework in 2013. Today, open disclosure has become a normal, if still challenging, part of clinical practice. Health service organizations are required to have an open disclosure program that is monitored as part of the National Safety and Quality in Health Services Standards. Open disclosure has also become part of many other standards, including the National Safety and Quality Primary and Community Healthcare Standards and the National Safety and Quality Mental Health Standards. Open disclosure can also be considered a patient and consumer right as part of the Australian Charter of Healthcare Rights. I have a right to be told if something has gone wrong during my healthcare, how it happened, how it may affect me, and what is being done to make care safe. Many Australian jurisdictions and healthcare organisations have adapted the Australian Open Disclosure Framework to their own local needs. For example, Queensland has developed a mnemonic tool called STARS for clinicians to use during initial discussions with patients immediately following an adverse event. The most significant legislative change has been Victoria's introduction of a statutory duty of candour in 2022, which makes open disclosure a legal requirement for Victorian providers following incidents deemed to be serious adverse patient safety events. Revision of the Australian Open Disclosure Framework. The Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare is currently revising the 2013 framework. In reviewing the framework and its implementation, it has been found that states, territories, and health services have made considerable headway to raise the priority of open disclosure and have policies directing open disclosure implementation. Some challenges, however, remain. Health services appear to be at different levels of maturity, with inconsistencies in relation to how the 2013 framework has translated into practice. Feedback from surveyors show that while most health services have implemented and normalized open disclosure in practice, there are still some that have not implemented policies or training for their staff. While the framework remains fundamentally relevant, it will be revised to improve its clarity and to use more person-centered language. The revision will consider the changes that have taken place over the past 10 years to the delivery of healthcare, including the growth of virtual healthcare. We need to consider how to better support integration of open disclosure with other systems, including incident management and complaints. We will also review the suitability of the open disclosure framework for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and culturally and linguistically diverse communities. In revising the framework, we have to consider the fundamental challenges we are trying to engage with, namely that the open disclosure process is fairly simple. People are complex, and how they react to crisis or experience grief differs significantly from person to person. Open disclosure requires communication skills that do not always come naturally to people, but can be learned. Healthcare professionals are often worried about the impact of their careers of engaging with open disclosure. Low-level open disclosure, sometimes called informal or clinician disclosure, is done often by many health practitioners without a problem. High-level open disclosure remains challenging for many health practitioners. In developing the revision of the Australian Open Disclosure Framework, the Commission is considering these fundamental challenges that remain and how we can best support policymakers, healthcare providers, and on the ground, clinicians, to practice open disclosure effectively.
Thanks for tuning into this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website at www.thecommuniques.com, which also include hyperlinks and a list of resources and any references that our case summary authors and our experts have recommended. I'm Nicola Cunningham. Thanks for listening.